EJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm sharing a conversation with author and educator Bengi Akblut. Bengi speaks in this conversation about some of the critical issues that we face today, looking at the intersections of the climate crisis and economic injustice. And I think, broadly speaking, I wanted to have this conversation with Bengi, who is somebody I think that can offer some critical insights into thinking about how social change happens. We talk about some of the challenges that progressives have faced in building power, in building organizations, and thinking critically about questions of state power today, as we're seeing such an assertion of brutal force and, you know, imperialism from the United States. Bengi is a professor in the geography department at Concordia University and is the co-director of the Social Justice Center. So here is my conversation with Bengi for Free City Radio.
One of the major challenges that I think progressives, I mean, that's a term that could be unpacked, but let's just say people who are trying to push for meaningful change that is oriented towards justice or more sense of sort of an equitable economic and environmental social context. One of the challenges I think that a lot of people face today and a lot of people are thinking about is the question of like institutions. How do we come to terms with this? Especially, let's say we're in Montreal in this Western context where, we're seeing this rising fascist right, right beside us in the United States. But of course, that's not without context. And I'm just, thinking about what does that mean for us? What does that mean when we think about the challenges around institution building in the sort of reality that liberal institutions are under attack in a sense. I think that this could tie to some of your thinking and work around degrowth and let's say ecological justice, because there's a lot of lessons to be learned in terms of a radically different approach to questions like institutions, to questions like how we structure society. I know you're teaching a new course right now here in Montreal called Environmental Governance, which could be like a really awesome framework, but also could be a totally problematic framework, depending on how it's implemented. Those are a lot of questions. Maybe we'll just start there. I think the whole idea here was to have a bit of an open conversation around some kind of things that I keep hearing people talk about. Maybe there isn't resolution points and that's okay. So maybe you could just introduce yourself to start and any thoughts about the points that I just highlighted. Thank you.
I really like your framing of the challenge around institutions. And I think it was a challenge even before we started seeing kind of the quote-unquote attack on institutions, not only by the far right, but like fascist right, but also I think in different ways, they kind of periodically come under attack, I feel like. In a way, I think the challenge, the kind of broader challenge, is how to take institutions seriously, but without fetishizing them or like without reifying them, without making them the entire focus and locus of politics. I think it's a question that many of us have also faced, kind of, or keep facing, kind of building emancipatory politics and transformative emancipatory politics, for instance, outside of the state. So it's a it's an institution that we cannot overlook or like kind of just neglect. But there's also kind of the trap of kind of, I mean, for those of us who refuse kind of to do a state-centered politics or state-centered life, nation-state-centered life, how do we build a political base that also takes state seriously, so or takes that into account, and how to take state or institutions seriously without making them the privileged site of politics or transformation? I think that's a bigger question that has, again, that doesn't have an answer, but I think it's a question that animates, that should keep animating our position, right? And I think when you said that kind of these liberal institutions are under attack, I think that's one thing that kind of shows us how easily crumbled these institutions are. A very similar question actually came up, not a very similar, but a question about policy making and kind of regulation, or particularly regulating and taming kind of big oil companies, for instance, came up in my class that you just mentioned, environmental governance. And I think many of the young people in my class are very aware that there is no such kind of institution that is infallible, or like there is no such policymaker that is all good-willed and like is only interested in kind of the public good. Or so I feel like they're a lot more realistic about, because they are, I think, also coming of age at a time where all these institutions are crumbling down, basically. So I think it's a good reminder that there's not much to be expected. I mean, of course, there's a way to work and to, for instance, to lock down policy that will be protective and or that will be kind of conducive to the kind of socioeconomic justice and meaningful and dignified life that we're fighting for, in a way. But I don't think they are... I mean, I think like what we're seeing around us to different degrees is how they're not guarantors of anyone and of any right that has been won, any space of emancipation that's been won by organized collective mobilizations, and not only mobilizations, but organized kind of movements. So not only kind of spur of the moment mobilization, but kind of sustained collective organization or organizing that kind of, whose kind of larger question is how do we live together and how do we govern ourselves? So these institutions can be worked to further that agenda, but in a way, the liberal institutions or the wins that we've, victories that they represent maybe, or they kind of institutionalize, have always come with sustained social mobilizations. So it's not the kind of, it's not the institutions that actually represent the kind of victories. It's people. It's people who pushed for these gains and kind of institutionalize them. So to the extent that institutions demobilize and pacify, I feel like sustained organizing, and I will explain what I mean by that. It doesn't mean kind of being on the streets all the time and demonstrating for me, but in the absence of sustained organized societies, sustained organized communities, I think there's always kind of this danger of those institutions being turned against us or being under attack and dismantled or whatever. So, I mean, and I think it's a good kind of sobering moment to see that, although it's destructive for many people. It's very harming for these institutions to be under attack that way. Whether kind of what we mean by institutions is like public healthcare or public education or like certain kinds of protections to keep housing affordable and accessible for people. So I think, like, for especially in the context of Quebec, I think these are some of the more pressing crumblings down or attacks against kind of public institutions. But what I mean by kind of sustained organization or sustained organizing is, I get this kind of, there are many kind of people who think about kind of this notion, for instance, from Latin America, Raul Zibechi talks about kind of societies in movements, where he's focusing especially in the kind of last two, maybe early 2000s, late 1990s, early 2000s, communities who have kind of come up with their own institutions of self-governance and making not only political decisions, but governing everyday life. So how do we live together collectively? So they have assemblies, or they have forms of collective labor, or they have forms of collective contribution to support kind of community members. Different communities, different societies, different groups. And in Rosie Bechi's kind of view, these institutions, these informal institutions of self-governance of everyday life, are the very tools and weapons that these societies fight with when they're under attack. So these kind of institutions of self-governance is what makes us communities, but also that's what makes us resilient when the liberal institutions are under attack and like when they come and they try to kind of expropriate our land or expropriate our housing or whatever. So when there's like more of a kind of aggressive attack, these are for him, this is how these communities fight or resist. So you also brought up degrowth and environmental justice and kind of my also other broader work on economic democracy and kind of democratic economic projects, initiatives, worldviews. They also build on an idea of self-governance, self-determination, and building institutions and kind of arrangements of those, not only because it's just and it's nice to have them, but that's also how many people want to live with. And so institutions, in a sense, that are not liberal, but directly democratic and directly kind of speaking to how we want to live. I mean, kind of practically what that means is, I don't know, like, what that means. Kind of, it's hard to imagine, like, for many people, directly democratically run institution, but I think that's where we should be kind of focusing on right now, rather than trying to recuperate or defend the liberal institutions. I think we should be thinking about what would be our institutions and infrastructures of self-governance and self-determination to collectively live together.
I'm going to respond on some of the ideas stuff in a minute, but when you were speaking, I'm sure that images or places or people were coming to your mind, and I think that could kind of be an interesting way of unpacking some of the ideas that you shared, is just like grounding people in an understanding of place or places or experiences or people that come to your mind when you're sharing those ideas.
Of course. I mean, when I brought up the Raul Zibechi, I was thinking of a lot of like Latin American experiments in autonomia or autonomous kind of self-governance, self-determination. He has obviously, so these are things I've read and like some of which I've seen, but for me, the most important point of reference has always been the Kurdish freedom movement and how the kind of, especially the Kurdish freedom movements, kind of more recent, I would say, in the last two decades or so of like trajectory of moving away from a political demand for a nation state, but rather, or at least the part of the Kurdish freedom movement who's kind of in Rojava and Bakur in Turkey and Syria, but PKK and kind of the larger ecosystem around it, and how their kind of political demands have evolved more to what can be called a democratic society, democratic autonomy, and democratic communal economy. So, and rather than kind of building the institutions of a nation state, which was seen as kind of the political solution to a population and nation that was actually, that is colonized by four different countries. But the movement has started kind of even criticizing the notion of nation state and how that colonizes, the nation state itself colonizes people's ability to self-govern and self-determine. So they started formulating their vision more along the ways of how do we govern ourselves and where, what would be the institutions of this governance, of self-governance and self-determination, and without kind of fetishizing these institutions themselves. So they came up with, I mean, of course, they didn't just make up these things. There are many experiments like this, but the one that, I mean, since we're talking about the Kurdish Freedom Movement, so that kind of the institution of an assembly, for instance, the neighborhood assembly or a village assembly, so it can be like at a different, at a kind of particular geographical unit, making decisions about how to run that neighborhood, what the needs of that neighborhood is, what kind of labor is needed to attend to these needs, and how do we collectively, for instance, come up with that labor, and where everyone not only has the right to kind of participate and democratically shape that process, but also everyone is expected to contribute. So it's not a representative democratic situation, but it's also our involvement is not only about rights, but it's also about our collective work, and collective life is produced by collectively producing that life in a way.
Explain that work.
So if we discuss and we decided that there is like the park that in the neighborhood needs to be cleaned, or like we need like more green space in the neighborhood, and we don't delegate that to someone, we do it ourselves, and that kind of act of doing it, producing what we need in that neighborhood together, is the basis of what makes us a community from this perspective. So that collective labor, sharing that labor together, is what builds community bonds. But it is also a way in which we can discuss our needs without being severed from who's going to produce, who's going to cater to those needs. So it's self-determination of needs as a form of, as a side of, as a dimension of self-governance. But also we are fulfilling our needs ourselves. So this kind of, I mean, I'm not going to get, I will also get into the more economic part of it, what this perspective and institutional kind of background or the infrastructure of a democratic communal economy would be. But even at this stage, it's taking responsibility collectively for what we need without kind of delegating that need to, for instance, a state institution or to the nation state, for that kind of relying on the state to deliver us a service that we need, is something that is rejected within this kind of perspective. It's the community discussing what it needs and then kind of sharing the responsibility and organizing the labor of producing that need is kind of the fundamental basis of self-governance. And so, for instance, in this neighborhood assembly is not kind of this separated political institution of self-governance, but it is nested in, for instance, the same neighborhood can decide, for instance, out of this assembly, can decide to build, for instance, a cooperative. So, for instance, we need a daycare. There's no daycare in the community. So, what do we do? Okay, let's build a daycare. It's not the institution of a cooperative that is more important, but it's more that we as a community collaborate and collectively produce this daycare.
Got it.
So This, and then there are other kind of assemblies that are more kind of, for instance, there's a youth assembly, there's a women's assembly, there's a there's an economic kind of council that is kind of, so this kind of form of self-governance in every facet of social life is foreseen to be instituted through assemblies and then some coordinating bodies that are at upper scales. So talked about the neighborhood, but then, for instance, the city, and then there's the region that is not supposed to be taking decisions that are going to be applied from top to down, but are more like coordinating bodies to of like different local institutions. To what extent this is being implemented in Kurdistan? It's tricky because for Rojava is where this is most implemented, the part of Kurdistan that is in the northern part of Syria, because it is an autonomous region. But it is not, it has not still kind of, it cannot be said that it has completely replaced kind of the infrastructure of the Syrian nation state that was mostly defunct through the Syrian civil war. But still, it's kind of, it exists in parallel with kind of this liberal, if you will, or like nation state institutions. In Bakur, in the part of Kurdistan that is within Turkey, it's not really, I mean, this is not really implementable that much because the Kurdish freedom movement has been criminalized so much in the last 10 years after the last round of peace talks had fallen through. There's a different resolution process right now, so we don't know how that's going to kind of, if that's ever going to open up space for this vision of local institutions of self-governance, let's say, can be restarted or can be rebuilt.
Well, so there's sort of a description here of like a social, economic, cultural, layered reality to sort of think about these larger questions. So thanks for getting into the example that you highlighted. How do we tangibly... Well, I could say like one thing listening to you that came to my mind was that participating in those types of processes, especially at a local level, can really be a sort of a balm against some sort of sense of cynicism or even isolation, right? But then you get into all these questions about governance structure and decision-making process and protocol, which are things to be discussed and worked out. But I think often the questions around that are based in the idea or based in sort of a cultural understanding that the other models are working well, right? So just for people who might be thinking about that, I don't think that necessarily like the Western liberal model is working very well. We can see that right now. Why do you think that thinking about these sort of alternative conceptions, but also experiments in infrastructure are important right now in the face of rising fascism, right? Because I think what I'm hearing a lot is people retreating to sort of defending liberal institutions, right? Which I'm not sure how I feel about it, to be honest with you.
We are kind of pushed to that corner in a way. I think many of us have felt like we are put in a position to defend things like the very corporate notion of like equity, diversity, and inclusion, for instance, or like the very corporate mainstreamized versions of it in the university or like in whatever civil society settings. But like this is what we had criticized all our kind of since the beginning, and then like we find ourselves kind of defending it. But I think That is the most sinister, I think. Like, I don't know, I don't have any claim that it is the most, but for me it is the most sinister part of fascism, is that it, as it rises, even if it's not in the exact place that we are in, even if it's somewhere else, as it emerges, it forces kind of a right-wing compromise everywhere else. It's like because they attack, it attacks, or like we fear that these institutions will be attacked so badly that we're kind of trying to keep like some version of it that's still gonna work instead of, as you said, imagining or experimenting with different forms of how we institutionalize living together, such as Rojava, or such as experiments in Italy, or like where, like there are many, and I think even every mass mobilization that was sustained through, like the student, for instance, movements here in Montreal. It had its own institutions of decision making, the assemblies, for instance. The students had, like, it was, no mass mobilization can be sustained as like spontaneously. So there were ways in which the mobilization was, maybe there's a street demo, but then people, and in many more examples that I have too, like in mind, there were always places where people met to discuss what this movement is about and what are its demands. And that is a way, that is an institution too. That is an institution where people come together and they connect their daily life to the macro structural forces and speak about what their demands are and see that they're not the only ones who are suffering under these conditions. So it's where politics happen. It's where issues get politicized.
That was a conversation with academic and educator Bengi Akblut, who is at the Geography Department at Concordia University and is the co-director of the Social Justice Center. Thanks so much to Bengi for being on the program this week. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this has been another edition of Free City Radio. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thank you to the Social Justice Center for supporting this program. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. We're also a podcast. Look us up. Just search Free City Radio on your favorite podcast platform. And thanks so much for tuning in this week. I'll talk to you next week. I'm Stefan Christoph. Take care.